my name's Stephen Ridgway, and this is a Talking VTE number 23 for the March 17th, 2010. This is actually the first Talking VTE for this year. So perhaps we'll go around and do a bit of a check-in and who's here. Perhaps we'll start with the live audience here in Sydney.
Hi, it's Robin Jay here. Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone. It's Melanie Dorian here in Sydney too.
Oh, well, perhaps we'll cross over to you, Alison, there, and you're in Melbourne.
I am. I'm a South Australian native, but in Melbourne at the moment. So, Alison Miller here.
Thank you for joining us at short notice. I imagine you're in a hotel room, are you?
That's right. Looking out over a very bizarre type environment, yes.
We're in Camperdown, which is very close to Sydney, also looking over, well, it's not bizarre, but it's a sort of
beautiful
panorama of Sydney. So, and of course, another South Australian native, Michael Coughlin. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Stefan. And this South Australian native is in South Australia.
For the time being.
And we also have Alexander Hayes, or Alex as we know him, fondly know him, in Orange. Evening, Alex.
Good evening. Affectionately known as Alexander Hayes. How are you all?
With his head in a big conch shell or
something.
Yeah. I've got my small office voice on tonight.
Well, tonight was more just to sort of get together and to try to get the podcast happening for 2010, because it's been a little difficult to get off the ground. So thanks for everyone for jumping on board at short notice. Look, I guess just a sort of quick go around and what's really struck you in 2010 as significant and salient in the sort of technology / education / network learning arena. We had a few topics on the wiki page. Probably Alison hasn't seen those, and they involved about one of them was the return by educators to gated platforms. And I think you mentioned earlier the sort of, you know, the draw card of Moodle. If you run a Moodle workshop, you're guaranteed to fill it. So I think that exemplifies that, you know, there is perhaps a shift away from the open web, but we can discuss that. Perhaps also exemplified by the widgetization of the mobile web, the way in which the mobile web is being broken up into different little pools, the Apple App Store, and now the Google App Store, and of course Windows has also, Microsoft also announced an App Store as well, so that's another thing we can talk about as well. E-books, you know, whether the iPad's going to transform the publishing landscape, the educational landscape with it, and any new technologies that we've all probably had to play with, Wave, Buzz, etc., and whether they think they'll have an impact on education. So perhaps it's going around, starting with you, Robin.
I want to put something else on the agenda, and that's actually what I think is a shift away from an emphasis on tools in the educational sphere and back to thinking around strategies and what I have seen termed this week social instructional design. So I'll put that on the agenda for later.
No, it's a good one. No.
But in terms of tools, I've been having a wonderful time with my iPhone and spent an hour this afternoon tidying it all up, and I think I've still got about 30 apps on my iPhone.
I think that has been a real change. I think we've all probably got iPhones. I think all of us here. What about you, Alison? No,
I'm an anti-iPhone.
Oh, well, that'll be interesting.
Sorry.
Get your perspective on that.
Android.
And
maybe an Android lover, but not definitely. How could you be an iPhone hater?
A number of reasons. When I went to buy a mobile phone, contract for a mobile phone, because I don't know if you ever buy them these days. did a bit of a product matrix as to some of the features that I wanted. And at the time, I wanted a decent camera, and I wanted video, and I wanted to be able to Bluetooth files to other people, and the iPhone couldn't do any of that.
Well, I think we might argue that point.
Well, when I went for the Find, they had a crappy camera, they had no video, and it still can't Bluetooth files to one another.
We don't need to Bluetooth, we bump.
Yeah, but you can't bump files to each other.
Yes, we can.
Music files?
Music files, image files, contacts.
Okay, so that must
between
be something.
Between iPhones. Between iPhones.
That's between right. iPhones.
Again,
that's right.
Again, it highlights the closed market, the walled garden that iPhones do, because you can only bump with another iPhone. You can't actually share files generically with other mobile devices, which you can do with Bluetooth and mobile devices.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to send it. I mean, send contacts and stuff like that, of course.
I mean, I
actually love the camera on my iPhone, because I've got an SLR, as you know.
Yep.
And but I'm quite happy using my iPhone camera. I think it does a fine job. You can see in my Flickr stream quite a lot of my images are off the phone. It does a great job with close-ups or whatever. I've got apps that will zoom, and I use stuff to lighten and darken and crop. I've got an app that crops and an app that stitches together panoramas and an app that does fisheye stuff, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think what Apple did in coming into the mobile phone market, and they were a completely new entrant to that space, was to demonstrate that you could actually do something different with the phone. The phone could actually be more than just SMS and VoIP and MMS. And you know, I think for a long time the space had been pretty much entrenched by telcos and phone manufacturers who were in each other's pockets, and there was just no innovation going on. And I think they were just milking the market and really stifling innovation. And I think, I hate to say it, I think Apple really did drop parachute in there and say, look, we can do this different.
Alison, I suspect they won't stay there. There will be replacements pretty soon. So.
Well, good.
Yeah, they also have a very strong control over what applications are allowed in the market. So, I don't know, they were quoted this morning as being a sterile walled garden that only allows certain features to be appearing in its app store. But as I said, I'm not a big Mac Apple fan. I'm not, mainly because you're talking about a specific economic, people in the market who can afford Macs are lucky enough to get them, and the rest of us just have to deal with what's available there. And I'm the sort of person, if you say that everybody's getting an iPhone, it makes me think, maybe I should be looking somewhere else. And it's not just about iPhones, it's about lots of things in life. If everybody's rushing over there, I think, that's obviously where I not need to go. But I think that actually Android, an open source operating system on a mobile phone, will allow a lot more applications to be developed that aren't controlled by big corporations like Apple.
Sure, just by Google.
No, because it's an open source application, so they might go through Google's store, but App Store, because of the business model that enables people to access resources and applications, but it won't certainly be dictated like Apple do.
No, I think that's absolutely correct, and I think Google's entrance to the space will force Apple's hand, I think, on it, and you're right, there's been a lot of criticism from developers around the App Store, where people put in all the work to create an app, and then Apple just refuses to allow it on the store, or they have it there on the store and then it gets pulled for one other reason or not. And it's not always just necessarily breaching the community conditions. It can be because it conflicts with Apple's business model, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, look, it has Apple has done a lot in innovation in the space, but they are traditionally inclined towards closed ecosystems. And, you know, their music store has always been that way, and, you know, the iPod ecosystem has been that way as well. So
there's also been a lot of complaints in terms of the iPhone being broken, that it breaks easily. There was a comment again on Twitter tonight or on Facebook tonight about somebody having their iPhone replaced, and I knew when I spoke to them late last year they were having issues with it then. So it perhaps is not as, you know, bright and shiny as and don't get me wrong, see, the touch functionality of an iPhone I think is brilliant, and I think what a mobile, a handheld device should be like, but there's a lot of the negatives that sort of make me think, maybe not.
I guess, Alison, one thing you could say, though, that with whatever your argument with Apple, and they're quite justified, the fact that they've entered the marketplace has stimulated all this other development, which I don't think would have happened without them.
Agreed. Yeah, certainly agree with that. So put a challenge out there. I wonder what's going to happen with Nokia, and I know we shouldn't probably, again, be talking about the tools, but I wonder what Nokia might be holding up its sleeve in terms of this arena and devices.
It's a good question, and certainly a lot of the stuff I've been listening to suggests that they, you know, one hand you could say that they've really perhaps fallen a little behind in terms of what you might call the social web or the mobile web or the smartphone, perhaps more importantly the smartphone market. But in recent terms, their CEO, particularly earlier this year, was suggesting that the third world was going to be their market, and that's where they were going to focus.
And the over 65s.
Yeah, but see, the over 65s like the iPhone. My folks have seen it on the TV and they like it because it's got those big numbers. But it's interesting, you know, like, we can't be bothered entering.
I bet they don't have lots of apps though, Alison. I think there's a market for people who don't want to have to put their glasses on every time they make a phone call or send an SMS. And really, that it just does a damn good job with phone and text messaging. They really don't want a lot more than that, maybe.
There's certainly accessibility issues with iPhones, so if you've got poor eyesight, there's no tactile way of sort of learning where the keypad is, especially when it moves all around. So there's, in terms of accessibility, and that bit of stuff about they're moving off to the third world, the first thing I thought of about was all the cigarette companies. You know, they were big in Australia, and when all the legislation costs got too high, we'll just go and sell our product to the third world. So it's a bit of a cop out, really, from Nokia's point of view.
Yeah,
but I think mobile devices will have a big impact in what we do, and I don't think in the learning. I mean, in the learning arena, we don't really get the e-learning part of it, let alone the m-learning or the u-learning aspect of it. But I think that models like iPhone and more connectivity through mobile devices will enable people to access information and networks through their mobile device. So I think it's a really important arena to be focusing in on in terms of learning.
Absolutely. Yes, I think as educators we need to really look very closely. I mean, Alex would be able to speak better than I, but I mean, he's been innovating with mobile phones and e-learning for years, and it just never got any traction at all.
It is now.
Yeah.
On that note, if I may, I'm just going to, I'm referencing what your conversation was talking about earlier, Stefan, about what you're up to and, you know, so on. If I may, if you bear with me for 1 minute, I'd just like to read something I'm writing. It's in a paragraph, and I just want to get not your opinions, but just put it in this, what's currently happening with me. I've been referencing or looking at the four current major iteration findings that have come out of the New Media Consortium's Horizon Report 2010. The abundance of resources and relationships make it easily accessible to the internet, increasing challenge to revisit roles as educators and sense-making, coaching and credentialing. Two, people expect to work, learn, study whenever they want to or wherever they want to, the notion of mobile learning. Technologies we use are increasingly cloud-based, or our notions of IT support are completely decentralized. And the fourth notion is that the work of students is increasingly seen as a collaborative exercise. It's more cross, and they've got campus collaboration between departments. And what I had responded to was, some would refer to this as the advent of a network learning model where the individual, the group, and the network, as Robin has coined, build social sense-making, or a living literacy that embodies electronic connections amongst all other human considerations for learning. These network human relationships, according to theorists, blah, blah, are amongst evidence of the rise of, and I've coined here connectivism, but I've, you know, looking at a whole range of different terms, where there's a preferential digestion of life-based learning, connection-dependent, technology-enabled. So really what I'm looking at is a study that looks at location enablement, human wearable, mobile learning, the connection between the wearable device and learning, and I think that's really where it's all heading. That's where things are for me.
Okay, well, perhaps we'll move on to Michael, because he hasn't said anything much yet. Michael?
Well, I can't speak on the issue of phones with any first-hand experience, but I'm really interested in the conversation because I'm going to buy one in the next couple of months. So I've been looking around and asking everybody, you know, how's your phone? What do you like about it? What's not so good about it? And I put a URL in the text chat of something I found last night, which is there are two articles there side by side. One's called Why the Android is Better than the iPhone, and the other one is Why the iPhone is Better than the Android. And looking at those two articles, it seemed to me if you want a phone that's good with media and can, you know, handle MP3s and video and latch onto all the applications and the iTunes store, obviously the iPhone is better. If you're looking for things more about a phone, and Bluetooth is certainly an advantage in the Android, then the Android, I reckon, from reading those two articles, and they were trying to be neutral, the Android comes out sounding like the better phone, whereas the iPhone comes out sounding like a better media device. So that's all I've got to contribute on the phone conversation. Shall I go on to talk about things that have, you know, things that have struck me this year at the moment, or wait a bit?
No, go on.
Any comments on Alex's?
It's a bit hard to comment on such a dense paragraph, Alex, when it's just read. I'd really need to see it.
Yeah, well, you can. Just go to alexanderhose.com/research. But I suppose the line, which you could respond to, is this research presents for me personally an opportunity to rigorously investigate where the applied use of these technologies are having an impact on learning, where the history of my own application of mobile learning in a range of educational-related industry sectors will further inform existing bodies of knowledge, and an opportunity to deeply consider the implications that this research might unveil both investigatively and subsequently. So really, well, the focus is mobile learning, but it is very much about taking the mobile phone moniker away, taking away the mobile learning moniker, and replacing it with wearable technology. Not in that notion, not in a scientific notion or in an industrial notion, but in a network learning notion.
Well, one of the things
we're all connected by that, we're all connected almost 24 hours a day by devices we all wear. We won't own up to it.
Not everybody is, Alex.
I don't wear anything.
I think one could argue, though, that people do wear their phones, and I'm using this metaphorically, the idea that it's on you all the time. Who's that? Sorry?
It sounds like the fart application in the iPhone.
Oh, dear.
That's it, that noise?
That one. Yeah,
that's me turning my headset, the microphone piece, up or down.
Okay, I'm glad
like
to hear that.
Things like burp without you hearing me.
Yeah. We just hear you farting.
Yeah. We did have this once before where we on one of our Talking BT sessions where there was a curious noise entered into the fray. We couldn't quite work out.
No one would own up to it.
It was me the whole time. I had a whole series of sound effects stored on the computer and I was replaying them.
That was you, was it?
Yeah, go back and listen to it.
Rat bag.
Who else would do it?
Right.
You're like one of these people that goes into Second Life and does all these sorts of things.
That's right.
No, but I've always found every environment that I have gone into in my whole life, I've always gone in To find out how it works, you have to antagonise it.
Antagonise it.
You're meant to antagonise the thing, not the people.
Yeah, well, that too.
What happened to interrogate?
Oh, was that what I was supposed to do? Oh.
Spelling was never your strong point, Alex.
Michael, we've got off the track. What were you doing?
I want to just draw Alex's attention to the point that when we read things like the Horizon Report, especially the one that comes out of the US, and Alison, this is the sort of stuff I wanted to talk to you the other day, I'm always conscious of the fact that most of that data comes from the US college university system, and I'm always wanting to bring it back to the context that we work in most of the time, VET, Australia, and how much of that stuff which we glean from elsewhere actually applies to the same extent in VET. And I think there's a big difference there. And I think your research, your PhD stuff would be a golden opportunity to not have that as a full, full front focus, but just remind us all the time that in VET, this is the situation.
I'd love to, but I'm looking at all education sectors in a national context. I totally take on what you're saying, Michael, because you have to read across campus, there's a whole range of nomenclature in the whole findings, but the findings were informed by an Australian, very informed contingent. Is that right, Robin?
The Australian Horizon Report.
But
yes.
That's not 2010. Michael and Alison, were you involved in that?
No, not me.
That was the 2009, but that.
Yeah, well, I suppose all I'm doing is pointing at the New Media Consortium's publications in general. I pulled out one that is the most current in terms of four key contemporary messages that resonate from what they're saying. If you go back in 2009, it's fairly similar. Other messages have been very similar.
Well, they have quite a bit of reach. I know certainly our institute director sent it down the line for us to read. So they have an impact.
Alex, did you think that the 2009 report was more accessible in language and content than the 2009? The Horizon Report.
I think it would be to an Australian audience for sure. I think to an Asia Pacific audience, most definitely. Mm. I think to a Eurocentric or a US based, I don't think they would have really. It would have really mattered because the context included vocational education training, adult community education. It was more holistic than the 2010 findings seem to be. That's what I can ascertain.
Look, I think that the things that you mentioned there are wish lists. I don't think it matters what sector you're in Australia, that those things are happening in pockets and by innovators. They're not happening at a general level.
But isn't it about trying to, find really good ways of people learning? So whether or not it's a school sector or a higher ed sector or the VET sector, it's actually about, is there a possible way of looking what I currently do? Is there a way that I might improve it? And would this help improve what I'm currently doing?
It's certainly about what's possible and what people should be investigating, if you like.
Just part of your continuing professional development.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would see it like that. But again, I would say that people actually implementing those things is a very tiny percentage.
And sort of addressing Michael's side of it, that's why I've sort of avoided talking about mobile learning as such, but more about body wearable technologies, because then you can bring in other areas of industry that are not necessarily about education and training, but it's about learning. By being connected, by being networked, and by being mobile, you're learning continuously on the move as part of that bigger.
Alex, can I play devil's advocate? It's Melanie. I think I understand where you're coming from, because you're wanting to shape people's conception, possibly, that they already know about mobile learning. This has been there, done that. And what you're saying, it's actually expanded. However, if someone was picking that up to read and you're talking about body wearable, their image starts to go back to things like, you know, the little suits that people wear to capture body movement in computer programs. I mean, I don't know that it's going to actually convey the sense that you want it to convey.
Well, yeah, in reference to where it came from, it actually occurs across many, many different sectors as the key term to describe where technology, like mobile learning, is predominantly a educational paradigm. It doesn't exist within a lot of industry contexts. It's not referred to as mobile learning or M-learning in many, many other different environments. The sciences.
Well, they're probably not educational in context.
No, that's right, but they still have a training and they still have a learning context to what they do, even though they're not necessarily within an educational context. And I know it sounds a bit dry. The main reason I've used body wearable is because what I'm looking into is the nature and effect of what location enablement is doing in terms of the mobile or body wearable or learning environment.
Yeah. Look, it was interesting when Google announced its, you know, the Nexus One. It didn't want to call it a smartphone. It wanted to call it. What did they refer to it as? A superphone or something like this? They're trying to demarcate it from the mobile phone, which I think is an understandable thing, and because of the social element to it.
I think the whole thing of phone is going to disappear very soon.
Yeah. The phone has a real legacy aspect to it, I think. And in many ways, in the modern, or the contemporary context, people will use the VoIP less and less on their phone.
I like the fact that you interceded there with a devil's advocate view on what I was talking about, Melanie. Don't get me wrong. I was only just trying to say that I'm trying to find other ways of describing what I would normally and comfortably call M-learning. Mm. When I talk to people from sciences and from different faculties or different schools of thought or whatever, they don't understand what I'm talking about when I say M-learning or mobile learning. They go, what?
No, it's just about connectivity. I mean, I don't see the wearable thing. If you went to most uni students and talked to them about wearable devices and wearable learning, they'd just look at you as though you're a bit of a nutter, I think. But you know, I see people walking around there either with an iPhone or with a netbook in their hand, all open, all day, and that's about being connected all day, no matter where they are. We've got Wi-Fi at the uni, so
yes,
they've got netbooks or that have got great batteries and that's life as a student now, yes. But they're not wearing them.
No, and it doesn't really matter. I think it's connected learning. I think that's or network learning. You know, that's
or an extension, isn't it? It's like an extension of
and
yourself.
And they wouldn't see it as learning either. They wouldn't but see it as learning.
But some of it's about the extension of yourself. So you're saying that these people, and I'm one of them. You know, like, if I walk out anywhere, I walk out with my mobile phone. In fact, there's some statistics to say that people are more likely to go out with their mobile phone than they are their house keys. So it's an extension of who you are instead of, and there probably will be a time where we will wear it because it will be a lot more convenient than humping around this thing in our hands all the time. So it's an extension of who we are and what we do. But I think you're right, Robin, they don't think of it as a learning because we've had these conversations about Facebook as well where it's all that tacit, you know, that sort of incidental type knowledge sharing that people do through these online spaces. And people who are educators, I think about it a lot. People who think about education, which I imagine all of us do, you know, try to contextualize where the learning is, the other 99.9% of the world just get on with what they're doing and everybody's learning on a daily basis. They just don't categorize it.
So you're saying that it's not worn, it's carried, that the technology is carried?
It's carried.
It's an extension. Yeah, sometimes I wear it. Sometimes I've got a lanyard. I wear it around my neck. Sometimes I wrap it around my wrist because it's a lanyard and it's there, but it's an extension of who I am and it's never very far from where I am.
No.
So in that context then, Alison, are you happy now that
over the last year or so that mobile devices, like laptops, phones, whatever, have become location-enabled. Because, you know, that's one of the biggest areas of growth that I've seen in the last year.
Well, I've
servicing.
Do you mean as in like an augmented reality type location enabled?
As in you can subscribe to services that are based upon where you're located.
Yes.
That you're also informing other services as to where you're located, like Foursquare and so on, your social context. And that you could also be influencing other people's proximity of what they do by their knowledge of where you are located due to the fact that mobile devices is a location enablement device.
Well, you get you're getting location-based searches too. So on the iPhone with Google now, it will provide you, the search results will be based, given some algorithmic weighting to your geolocation.
You know, when it says, do you wish to, you know, enable the feature on each, the permissions thing, there's actually no laws written behind that at all. There's no need for them to actually ask that of you. It's actually a courtesy thing.
Oh,
but
sure.
The Google phone, like the Android phone, is very much about serving information to you based on your location in a geographical sort of mode. I understand it. So, Michael, if you're going to choose an Android phone, be aware that Google's also not just mapping what you're receiving and sending. It's also, you know, doing it about, you know, where your location is.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so...
My current 2 years old phone already does that.
I was going to say, does the iPhone not already do that?
Yeah,
every phone
does.
Every phone does it. It constantly pings the server and tells the machine where you are. But the services that you can now add to your phone and the way that you use your phone has sort of, I think, have changed in the last year.
I agree with you, Alex. They have changed. I think geolocation has started to creep into so many things. And, you know, that with augmented reality as well, it's really quite a profound change in the way we can use the phone. In fact, it's fantastic, actually.
Yes.
Mm. So it's like, it's... That's the biggest thing that's affected what I now consider to be a real positive, like Bill started on it, Bill Wade started looking at it, in his last year's project, I think it was, on geo-enablement. And I think that this is a real richness that we're missing in terms of network learning that we still could, if we consider that as part of the mobile learning, for want of a better word, area, but it could open up an awful lot.
Yeah.
I think it's just at the beginning though, Alex. I think you'll see in the next year or two there'll be a lot more of that augmented reality stuff. There was somebody at the Mobile Monday in Adelaide here on Monday talking about an augmented reality experience at WOM Adelaide, so where you could point it at a stage and it would tell you who was playing and lots about information about who was playing, and if you were so far away from the event, it would start to sort of do a demo of what it potentially would be like if you were out there. And so I think we're just at the cuff of what's happening in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was in Auckland and I was travelling across with John Isles from Waiheke Island to Auckland, I heard and met this young fellow who had developed a social media service that was about tagging the interiors of various organizational structures, not in a XYZ axis, labels, you know, adding pictures, phones, notes, voice messages and so on. And it was incredible, just the trip going across from the island to the city. How many things are being tagged across the ocean, never mind on land?
Doesn't Flickr already do something similar too with imaging?
Yeah, it does with imaging, yeah.
The camera does and then allows metadata to be uploaded into it. But what about some of the other things you had there, Steph, before, where the e-book area and iPad? I'm just wondering what people were thinking about that.
Yeah, that's a dub.
I think you'll find it will actually have...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I think
it's
a gimmick. That's what I
like.
Have you seen one?
I posit it as the next PDA.
No, I think they're beautiful.
I mean, they're beautiful things. And if you've got money to burn, then and you want to curl up on your sofa and, you know, browse the web or read something, it'd be a pretty nice way of.
But I do that with my iPhone now. Like, for instance, I watch Q&A and I Twitter away while I'm watching Q&A on ABC. Yeah. And I do that with my iPhone, and I'll be watching television and I'll hear something and I Google it and I read it while I'm doing it.
I didn't know you could do two things on the iPhone at the one time.
Not as a male. But if if there was such thing as a radioactive battery-powered, you know, 4-week battery for an iPhone, then we would definitely be buying it, wouldn't we?
Well, I guess what I was saying is that ostensibly the iPad is a big iPhone or a big iTouch. And,
no, it's not a big iPhone, it's a big iTouch.
Well, they are going to bring out a 3G enabled one. That's going to be iffy at the moment.
The iPhone is a computer, the iPad is not.
Sorry?
I mean, in terms of apps and stuff like that, I don't think there'll be...
Oh, yeah, you can get all the apps. The only thing the developers have to do is scale. At the moment, apps that are designed for the iPhone just appear the same size on the iPad, but they've put out a new SDK so that you can scale them up to maximise the real estate of the iPad, and that'll just take time for the app developers to do that.
But I'm sure that some of the things I can do on the iPhone, you won't be able to do on the iPad.
Now it uses the same OS. So, in fact, it's got a faster processor, more memory, better graphics. It'll just run better.
Reading files, taking notes.
Yeah, all those things. It runs on the iPhone OS. So.
But what about the concept of changing a quite paper-based environment, so books, textbooks, to a more digital environment?
Hooray.
Publishers are very keen to explore that because they can see their market disappearing before their eyes.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, I would like. I'd like to see some evidence of the technology and its impact on eyes and eyesight. Though, I mean, really,
the bright light behind it all the time.
Yeah,
we have three publishing houses as clients who are using POV technologies to augment electronic. Books, textbooks, e-textbooks. So it's interesting that they are moving that way.
Well, Sony was the pioneer here. They've had e-book readers for quite some years, but they just gain no traction at all. And the reason why partly is because they were trying to simulate the contrast, black and white contrast they get on paper. So the whole focus there in those early days, which is not that long ago, 5 or 6 years ago, was to create e-ink. They weren't LCDs in the strict sense, so they were purely black and white, and they had like a massive contrast between the white and the black, and very, very high resolution screens. But that's all they could do, just black and white. And the Kindle is like that, you see. So hence that's the term the e-book came out of the e-ink tradition. Now, Apple's tried to sort of challenge that by saying, no, people don't want these devices that have screens that can't show multimedia. We're going to try to converge the e-book with the iPhone and with the iPad and have a multimedia experience. You're not going to lose the web by having to have an e-book.
I do see a use. I mean, if I was to buy an iPad, it would be for my father, who's 95 and loves reading the newspaper and is losing his eyesight.
Absolutely.
Because I think there's a lot of potential there for older people and for people who are vision impaired and stuff.
They definitely don't need keyboards anymore, that's for sure.
I think the fascinating convergence, if you want to talk about convergence, is for a long time we had, like, the netbook was a good example of this. Microsoft, again, missed the market. They were constantly on the trajectory of producing bloated software with Windows Vista, and it simply couldn't run on netbooks. The netbook revolution or market phenomena just came out of nowhere, and suddenly there was this market for very cheap, highly portable, but actually quite low resourced computers. They had very didn't have big processing, and the one focus was to do one thing: run the web browser. That's all a netbook's designed to do: run a web browser. That's all about connectivity. It's all about the cloud. And the interesting thing I think about both the iPhone OS being taken over and put onto a you know, a large form factor device like the iPad, and you see this discussion in the media. It, you know, will it confuse people? Will they think? Will they think when they buy it that they're getting a laptop, but they're actually getting a phone OS?
Well, that's right, and that's what I was meaning. I mean, unless you got a lot of money, you would end up having that for doing those things, yeah. And you'd still have a laptop for doing your.
Yeah.
Now, image editing and stuff.
What's interesting is that Google's OS is Android. Now, Android can actually be ported onto bigger devices like laptops. You can actually get a laptop and put Android on it. And really, all Android was designed to do was run one thing, Chrome OS. Chrome OS is actually Android, and it's basically the operating system. Android's for the phones, but Chrome OS is the platform that's Android designed for wider devices, but it is designed to run one thing, the Chrome browser. So you've now got an operating system that's whole function is to run one application, a web browser. That's astonishing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a real blurring of the boundaries between the phone, the laptop, the PC, you know.
Unfortunately, people want to also use other things that don't talk to Chrome.
Like Moodle.
But the Moodle. The concept, though, of operating via web browser on a mobile device is actually really important, because that actually helps overcome, doesn't it, help start to overcome some of the issues with mobile devices. So instead of creating applications for a specific mobile device, what you do is create web spaces that you're able to access via your mobile device. It doesn't matter which mobile device you're on. So from a developer's perspective, you're actually only developing for a widescreen device and a smaller screen device,
yeah.
And that's triggered depending on what device is that's trying to access it.
Yeah.
So that actually is quite a good way of thinking, if you're thinking, well, let's make all of these environments web-based. If you're saying that people are going more away from a phone per se and more using it as a way of connecting with people, Google are bringing out their own phone, because we keep talking about Google Android, but Android's actually at this stage on more different handsets. Like, I don't think Google phone is actually out. So
Done
Google
Australia.
Has developed. Yeah. So more. Well, there's device. There's mobile
Certainly
phone.
Not China.
Beg your pardon?
Certainly not in China either. The Google phone is not out in China.
No. Google's bad word in China, isn't it? So, yeah, it maybe that's the way they were thinking, is actually pushing to at least a standard within the mobile devices that allow people to access information regardless of the mobile phone that they're on or mobile device that they're on. And I think that's really important in terms, if you're going to encourage people to do this ubiquitous or mobile or wearable learning technology, it's actually making it really simple, one, for people to access, but two, for people to design spaces and applications that people can actually use, and not sort of keep them in very, very siloed spaces that, yes, you can have it if.
Actually, Alison, I think I've just picked up the word you used there, which I think is really important. It was ubiquitous, because it captures that concept of wearable, mobile, connected. It doesn't mean that people will always be connected, but it's an opportunity. There's always an opportunity.
Hang on, I think we've actually lost Alex, and are you still there, Michael?
I'm here.
You're there, yes. We've lost Alison and we've lost Alex. So we'll just call them again. So that was interesting. You're back, oh no. So we're calling Alison.
So, Michael, what are some of the things that you've found that are new this year? Anything you've seen? Any trends?
Well, I'll just start, you know, at the much maligned Moodle. And obviously it's dependent on context, South Australian context. In TAFE, it's just there's just an ongoing explosion of Moodle.
Yep, it's pretty much everywhere.
It is pretty much everywhere, and Alison and I were both present at an event in Melbourne last week where that was reiterated. There were lots of reports of various organisations using Moodle. Now, there was a comment earlier that there was a feeling that people were going more towards the mainstream lockdown products in education. I'm not going to say that's not true, but there was a little segment at this event last week in Melbourne where there were five presentations in a row. One was on Moodle, another one was on Flickr, another one was on Creative Commons, another one was on OER, and there was a fifth one. So these five presentations talked about the use of free or open source tools that were all hugely successful. And this was really interesting because it was in the middle of a conference that had as its central point systems and interoperability. So you've got a lot of the very key players in Australia who are working on the design of systems and standards, acknowledging in public, look, the big stuff is actually happening in the open source and free world. Why do we bother doing what we do? Why don't we just go with Yahoo, Flickr, Google, Moodle? Because they're the success stories. Why is what we're doing, why is what we're doing not hitting the mark and producing these mass success stories? So it's not just a matter of people going to the lockdown. There's a lot of activity out there that's been recognized in this venue on Thursday that, well, shit, you know, most of the really big success stories are out on the open web.
Yeah, look, I'd agree with everything you said except Moodle. The fact that it's open source really means, when it comes down to it, yeah, that's great. And if I had to choose an LMS, I'd pick Moodle above any of the others. But it's still just an LMS. And as an LMS, it's a walled garden. I went to the iMOOC sessions, and I tell you what, they were all about locking stuff down and using things internal to Moodle. And they were not about network learning. They were not about the open web. And Moodle was being used exactly like Blackboard. It made no difference what it
was.
Well,
I'll add another perspective, which is more in sync with what you're saying, Robin. On Thursday night, there was the release of some data that John Mitchell and co. have been gathering about the capability of the VET teacher. And they produced two sets of data. One that said that and this was a survey of 2,500 VET teachers. So, okay, it's VET. It's not schools. It's not unis. It's VET. These 2,500 VET teachers around Australia considered using e-learning was the highest facilitation skill that was required as a VET lecturer. And only 5% of them believed that they had the skills to do it effectively. And that's what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with a bunch of people who are unwilling. We are dealing with a bunch of people who are frankly incapable and unskilled.
And that leads back to my initial comment, which, you know, actually came from Robbie Weatherly, who said things have gone around and have come back to instructional design, except that it is not the instructional design that was around, you know, 10, 15 years ago. It's about, you know, people understand the benefits of, you know, connectivity, and they understand the benefits of the tools and spaces, but they just don't know how to go about it. They
Yep.
don't know where to start. And that's where this kind of concept of social instructional design, if you like, comes in, which is more about how to enable connectivity, how to enable authentic learning in communities of practice, if you like, that are in your industry area with people in the field beyond your context, and that kind of stuff. It's not about the traditional instructional design model of, well, we know what you need to know, and, you know, we're going to devise it all up front and let it loose on you kind of thing.
Yeah, and as someone said, it might have been Clint Smith, that there's a real need for, you know, let's call it, or a course, or at least some kind of available instruction for teachers of all sectors to go through that kind of process. Okay, here's your content. What do you now do with it? What are the activities you're going to wrap around this content? And Clint was arguing that's what people don't know what to do. They just don't know.
No, they don't. And that's where the huge demand. I get the calls every second day, Mike, saying, you know, my organisation wants to get onto e-learning. I want to start doing online learning. Where do I start? And they get completely overwhelmed, or they make a tragic mistake and dial a consultant and get sold a package. Because there's very little out there for them to do. And even if it's a course, I think Robin's got a very good point. I think they need more than a course. They need a community of practice to share their ideas, to test them and trial them and gain in confidence and skill. So I couldn't agree more.
And that's where everybody here present has gone. That's how we've acquired our skills and knowledge, through inadvertently working together as friends and colleagues, you know, teaching each other in what we could call a community of practice.
Mm-hmm. A large one. Very connected one.
You know, the other thing that I read through the week that it's very obvious, but I'd never really thought about it, was that in the majority of the time, what teachers are doing are tweaking existing courses. It's very rare for people to design a course from scratch, totally from scratch. And I used to be paid to do it at Southern Cross Uni. I know it's a big job, and it's really quite a difficult thing. And yet I think that's what's needed with some of this stuff, you know, that it needs starting from scratch. It needs a total rethink about how it is presented and how learners are engaged.
And you do have, I mean, I was been looking at the three e-electives in the Diploma for TAA, which had been, the toolbox was put out last year. There's a number of online courses and face-to-face courses springing up around that. There's a demand. But when you look at it, it's still a fairly narrow, it's very skill-based. Facilitate e-learning. The design an e-learning program,
old
model.
Just let me interrupt for a moment. Alex is just about to leave us on the conversation. So thanks for joining us, Alex.
No problems at all. I've discovered that if I can bottle feed little Eamon, who's 9, 10 weeks old, 110 mils, he stays asleep till 1 o'clock, which gives Jane about 5 hours sleep, and she then is a very much more agreeable human to interact with in the daytime. And I'm very interested to see, if you have a look at that link, I'll put in the chat there, which if you could put that into the main recording links, Stefan, about how we really should be saying hello to people in China who are listening to and able to access the Talking VTA feed through the soso.com search engine, which is bigger than Google.
Yeah, well, they've been putting a lot of spam on the comment spam, Chinese comment spam, so they are listening or doing something.
No, you just need to press Google Translate and actually see what they're actually saying.
Oh, really? Have you noticed these?
A few of them, yeah.
Sorry?
I've seen some appear and then some disappear because...
Because I deleted them.
Because you deleted them.
That's right. Oh, dear.
Right, so we're very sorry, Leoshi, and...
I do, by formal apologies for those who tried to comment, I deleted them.
Now we're starting to get quite a diverse readership. I've got to put that Google Analytics on it to find out where things are coming from. Sorry, folks, really great to hear from you all. Really looking forward to interacting with you all the way through 2010. Gotta go and feed babies.
Okay.
Thanks, good Alex.
Night,
see ya.
Good night.
Oh, God, it's nice to have adult children.
It's nice not to have any children.
And I'd like to sort of wrap things up, Steph, and go and do some other stuff, so indeed. Maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, we're at 54 minutes, as the little clock says, so it's been great. Mm.
Can I just throw something in, which I don't expect any comment on, really, but just going back to the opening question, things that I've noticed this year, I just can't believe the amount of the world that's in Facebook, and I've caved in and joined them.
Oh,
and I keep seeing people on Facebook that I used to see in Twitter, and where people used to say stuff on Twitter, well, 3 years ago they used to say it in email, they're now saying it in Facebook. It's almost becoming, if you want to know what everybody's doing, you've got to be in Facebook.
I don't want to know.
Good on you, Steph. But you're missing.
And they're not saying it in Google Wave or Google Buzz?
Well, they might be, because I've had a look at both, and I just don't, you know, if I can't integrate Wave and Buzz really easily and quickly into my other Google accounts, then Google need to get their act together. I know Buzz is better than Wave, but, you know, am I going to go over to Buzz and do a very similar thing there that I'm already doing in Twitter and Yammer? I just, there's no benefit in me doing that. Mm-hmm. It's just another place to go. I haven't got the time.
I think it's more closed. Buzz is far more closed.
Yeah,
Twitter.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And it grafted itself onto email, which I think is an interesting concept as well.
Mm. Well, they would knock out the whole younger generation who don't even have email. Like, email's so last century.
Yeah.
So you wonder who their target market is.
Yes. And, of course, they got into a lot of hot water about the launch of it. They didn't. They just sort of parachuted it in onto people's inboxes. And there were a lot of privacy concerns, and it got to, well, the CEO had to make a formal apology that we got it wrong.
Which is not common with Google.
No.
I mean, the getting it wrong thing is not common, but
well,
they
this was a doozy, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
So,
yeah.
Alison, if the young people aren't using email, is it Twitter that they, or
it's
Facebook?
No, it's Facebook.
Only Facebook.
In Australia, it's Facebook.
Well, and MySpace if you're in a band or
But that involves a lot of self-direction, doesn't it? Or do they use it? Do they get an RSS from it?
They just log directly into it.
They're in all the time. They're in there.
Yep.
They're
all
in the time.
On their constant.
It's
so
their instant
coming up.
It's their instant messaging service. It's their email service. It's their photo sharing service. It's their tagging service. It's their status feed, their news feeds. It's their world.
Closed world, as it is. Well, the trouble is it's trying to make it the world, isn't it?
Well, more and more stuff is showing up in Facebook, Steph. Yeah, I mean, if you just about everything feeds into it now.
Yeah.
But it's not IM.
No, it is IM.
Yeah, it can be that too.
It's not voice. It's not voice.
No, it's not voice.
And I've had some interesting conversations with son number two, who's overseas and feeling a bit homesick at the moment, and bemoaning that his friends are all in Facebook, but he just wants to talk to them. And there's actually no way. They don't use GTalk,
Skype.
They don't use Skype.
But Robin, there's an interesting scenario. Dana Boyd, a few years ago, when she was here and was dealing with this social networking space and young people, who said that young people will actually text each other and want to deal in that format because they don't want to have the emotive relationship. They don't want to ask you how you are, and they don't want to hear that you're sad in your voice or happy in your voice. They just want to get to the facts, and that's how they deal with each other. And that's why young people often will SMS each other rather than each other.
Yeah, but that's not what Geordie's after at the moment.
No, that's right. His human needs need that more human contact. But they've sort of detached themselves to some of that emotive stuff by doing it through a text-based...
I think some of that is just the nature of being, you know, that age and being a little introspective, you know, or being a bit, you know... I think and my comment to him was, just tell them.
Just
I need to talk to you. You know, I need to hear your voice. Can you please download X or Y, whichever he chooses, and connect
that
with
might
me
be
on Friday night.
A really
night.
good topic for another podcast.
Indeed.
But I mean, just a quick example. My son's now on Facebook. He'll be 11 next month, and he'll go to soccer training with the neighbour, and we'll come home in the car. And then the conversation last night was, "Well, what are you going to do? I'm going to going to go on the computer. Well, I think I will too. So they live next door to each other, and then what they'll do is they'll go home, they'll go into Facebook, and then they'll go into instant messaging in Facebook and talk to each other that way.
But as a teenager, didn't you spend hours on the phone? Hours. I spent hours on the phone.
I think I was about 9 before we even had a landline in our house, and then there was this big caveat that you had to have 30 cents or something to put into that thing that sat in the corner. So, yes, I suppose by the time I got to a teenager, yes, we did. But we spoke to each other. We didn't sit and text each other.
No, that's right, but we had no choice.
When you're talking to someone, of course, on the phone or even with Skype or Gmail, it's mostly one-on-one. So what you can do in Facebook if you're texting is you're talking to, 300 people at once.
The other thing you can do is you can be doing other things while you're texting.
Yes. You don't have to ask for you don't have to keep that conversation going immediately. Mm. It'll be socially acceptable for you to step away, spending 10 minutes making your cup of tea or getting whatever and coming back and then continuing that instant message conversation.
Hmm. Yes.
Phone conversation or Skype, that would be acceptable.
Yeah, I do that all the time.
Hmm. Notice that, Steph. I don't expect I'm surprised if I get an instant response.
Some of us just cook dinner and all sorts of things while we're chatting.
Hey, I'm going to...
Yes, well, perhaps we should just...
Can I just ask one more question? Does anybody know anybody who's finding Google Wave or Google Buzz useful? Right, I'll take the deadly silence as an answer. Thank you.
I honestly wouldn't know. I haven't asked the question. But I will. Now you've asked it.
I think in terms of Wave, the general feeling of everyone I know, including quite geeky people, is they've given up. They're all willing to give it a try, but they've given up.
So there's no buzz about Wave?
No. And in terms of buzz, there's a bit of activity there. Nothing particularly exciting at this point. But
I think I think Mike made a good point that why would you do that when you're already using similar thing in Twitter? And people, there comes a point of, while we always like the next new thing, there's a comfort area that we get in the zone that we're in, and then we think, well, why would we change?
I just think they're different tools. Twitter for me is about connecting with a very large community of people who I value for their ideas. Mm. Buzz is not about that. Buzz is about connecting with a much smaller community of contacts and discussing links and discussing ideas and discussing issues in a much more
closed environment.
And the closed isn't quite the right word, but in a much more, because you've got the comments one under the other all together, it's contained is probably a better word than closed.
Would it therefore
so it's easier to follow
a conversation.
A conversation. Mm. In a sense, it's more like, it's much more like a discussion forum than Twitter is in that way.
You have to be very careful. It could be a real inbox killer too if it got out of control. But you can turn that off.
Yeah, you can turn that off. And we'll learn how to manage it.
Mm. I know.
I was going to say I'm leaving, but Alison's popped the question in there about Live at EDU, the Microsoft thing we're using at TAFE. Alison, it's good. It's very good, but it's just another Facebook. And why would I go in there when I'm already in Facebook? That's the drama we're going to have with Live at EDU. Mm. We're going to have a whole bunch of TAFE staff who start to use it like a Facebook connecting tool, but those of us who are already ready elsewhere, it's going to be a real hassle because you're going to have to add that to the spaces you communicate in.
Yeah.
And with that, I'm really going to go, okay? Yep. Lovely talking to you.
Thanks,
Michael.
Steph. Good night.
See you later, Michael.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
So, well, Alison, how's Melbourne?
Well, what we'll do is we'll draw the formal podcast to a close. So, thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alison.
Thank you.
Okay.